Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Elementary schools in Newark are participating in a nationwide health program created by a tech company that manufactures smart thermometers. The thermometers are synced with a smartphone app that enables parents to track fevers and other symptoms in their children. New York Times business reporter Sapna Maheshwari has been covering the issue. She joins us by phone. Welcome.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, thanks. How does this thermometer differ from what we get at the pharmacy? What does it look like?
So it looks like a little bit more of a, I guess it has a little bit of a screen on it. It doesn't look too different from the thermometers you might use otherwise. It's a little bit bigger, and you can buy one for kids that is in the shape of Elmo. And there's one version that plugs into your smartphone, and then there's another that simply syncs through Bluetooth.
What kind of data does it collect besides the temperature?
So it collects your temperature data, and then through the smartphone app, you can input additional symptoms, like if you have a runny nose or you're feeling very itchy or uncomfortable. You can put all of that into this app that pairs with it.
Kinsa is the company that makes this device, and it can track when areas of the if this is used properly, it can track areas where there are spikes in temperatures. How is that data expected to be used?
Exactly. So essentially, basically, marketers are always looking for new information that they can layer all their messages on top of. And that goes back many, many, many years, we all know. Mm-hmm. In this case, with flu and illness, the closest that a lot of companies have gotten is, say, trying to mine social media data. Maybe a bunch of people in one area are saying they're not feeling well, or they're feeling sick, or have the flu, or maybe they can get even closer by trying to look at Google searches, for example, for flu. But what Kinsa has been pitching to marketers and other companies is they're saying, you know, we have it essentially straight from people's mouths. Or their ear, if you're measuring it from a kid, you know. You don't even have to wait for someone to, you know, make a Google search. You're getting the data right away. And it's important to note that the company is saying they then aggregate that information to the zip code level. So they can then show a company, hey, fevers are spiking in this area. You know, if your Clorox disinfectant is recommended by the CDC, perhaps you could target your ads here before your competitors perhaps know that flu is on the rise.
How does it work? I'm trying to wrap my brain around it. So I send my kid to school in the morning. Do they have something stuck in their ear?
No, it only happens when you take their temperature.
So someone at school would actually have to take their temperature?
Yeah, or you would have to be using the Kinsa thermometer. But because Kinsa has been handing these out in schools, mm-hmm. That's one way they've been getting these into more homes.
They've expanded this to 500 school buildings around the country?
I believe so.
What are the schools getting in? I mean, they're getting these thermometers, but is it the same thermometer? Everybody uses the same one for all the kids? Do all the parents have to be on board with this?
Well, you have to pair it to the smartphone app. I believe if you just want to use it on its own and not connect it, then they wouldn't be able to get the data. And the pitch is that schools can then see if there is illness on the rise there to get a sense of, you know, kids are, if there's a cold going around or a fever going around.
Is Kinsa the only company working on something like this?
You know, I haven't looked more into it. When I was actually searching for one to be photographed, I saw there are other smart thermometers on the market, which is just an interesting thing for us all to be aware of, because smart sounds better, I think, as a marketing term. Mm-hmm. But when we really think about what's internet connected, you have to really think about marketing these days, because you can bet a lot of the time there's going to be an advertiser on the other end of it.
I mean, it might be really great for the CDC to know where there's spikes like this across the country, but otherwise it's a marketing tool.
That's what it seems like. It seems like that's one of the tools. They have also worked with pharmacies, and so Kinsa says that their mission is to stop the spread of flu. And so based on their own guidelines, they say that they are not going to allow anyone to target individual homes, and that they will only work with digital advertisers who are in line with their mission. But it raises the broader point, you know, what if another company was making something like this and, you know, didn't have those goals? And also, you do have to take the company's word for it.
Mm-hmm. Right. And what other options or opportunities do you see along these lines?
So I talked to a privacy expert who was saying, you know, there are, as more of the home becomes smart and, you know, different companies get insight into how we eat and live and breathe and how we feel, there is potential for, say, alcohol companies or cigarette companies to, you know, use our data and information or even just unhealthy food companies in ways that we might not expect. And I think that's the sort of interesting thing about this story is that it sort of makes you think of that old board game Mousetrap. Like the temperature is taken by the thermometer, and then it's somehow crafted into the zip code. And then Clorox targets the ad to the zip code, and then you buy the product. And then someone, you know, checks if you bought the product to see if the ad was effective.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of like as we introduce these smart objects into our home, like this thermometer or, you know, one of the many other products on the market, it's kind of like that game of Mousetrap is becoming more elaborate.
Huh. What are privacy experts saying about it, though?
So it was interesting. It really sparked a real conversation because while Kinza says that, you know, they are behaving ethically and they have a public health mission here, privacy experts are alarmed because we really have very little in the way of regulation around these sorts of devices. And it seems like all kinds of things from the Amazon Alexa to Google Home are making their ways into households very quickly. And our laws and the rules around that have not really caught up. And so it's a little bit of a Wild West. And I think it's challenging because one criticism that came up around Kinza after I reported this story was that Kinza wouldn't disclose the names of other advertisers it has worked with, citing confidentiality agreements. And some people were a little frustrated with that. They were saying, well, you know, they are benefiting from my fever information. Shouldn't I know exactly how it's being used?
And what's Kinza's response? Oh, they're just saying they have these privacy agreements, but what's the rationale for that?
They're saying, you know, for competitive agreements and when you sign contracts, I guess, with big advertisers, they cannot disclose who's using it. And so for the consumer, you know, you may not know necessarily how the information is being used.
How are parents responding to this? Do you know?
I saw a few parents talking about it online and who reached out to me, and they were surprised, you know, that this was being given out for free at schools. Mm-hmm. They felt that this information wasn't shared with them at the time, kind of, you know, made them realize, you know, nothing's free. But mm-hmm. at the same time, there are lots of people who pay for this product and also may not know the advertising going on behind it. And so it's just an important thing to consider as we sort of bring more smart products into the home.
Well, is this necessary for schools? I mean, could schools say, nah, we'll use our own thermometers and we'll keep parents posted on their kids' well-being ourselves. We don't need to participate. What's in it for the schools? Just a free thermometer?
Yeah, I think they are able to sort of get the free thermometer and try and keep an eye on how illness is traveling throughout the school.
Uh-huh.
But at the same time, I mean, I'm not sure if, I guess they have to decide for themselves mm-hmm. if it's worth the trade-off.
Amazon is trying to get into this market. What are they doing?
So this is kind of interesting. So Amazon has said they're not necessarily using information in this way, but they have filed an application for a patent that essentially describes how they could use someone coughing and sniffling while asking Alexa to do things to make specific requests, like maybe recommend chicken soup or suggest cough drops. And so in that same way, it's kind of suggesting that they could listen to things in your voice to determine if you have a cold or if your health is off. And it, again, sort of illuminates that idea of, okay, how could this be used to essentially sell us things?
And going back to the thermometer thing, has the CDC expressed any interest in that? I would imagine they would be.
Not that I know of. KINSA had actually sort of criticized the CDC's data as offering on delay. What's interesting is the CDC information actually comes from clinics and hospitals, according to our health reporter here, that can be a few weeks out and reports influenza-like symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
And so KINSA is actually saying that their data is even more accurate. So I'm not sure if there's a collaboration in the future, but so far it has seemed like they're criticizing the CDC data.
Huh. Well, Sapna Maheshwari, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
Oh, yeah. Thank you for having me.
That's Sapna Maheshwari. She's a business reporter at the New York Times. She's reporting about a thermometer that can be synced up with smartphones, and it's now being used in 500 schools across the country, including elementary schools right here in Newark, Ohio. We're going to have more Tech Tuesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The photo-focused social media app Snapchat this year helped register more than 400,000 voters. Other social media companies such as Facebook and Twitter also are playing a role in elections, reminding voters to fill out their ballots and encouraging them to then share them when they voted. And there's good reason. Nearly 7 in 10 Americans use some form of social media, according to Pew Research Center. Nasim Makia is founder of Outvote. It's a mobile app that gets users to text their contacts to remind them to vote. Nasim Makia joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Ann. Excited to be here.
Also with us is Kat Hofacker. She wrote about the larger topic of social media and voting for USA Today. She joins us by phone. Welcome to the show, Kat.
Hi, thank you.
How is voting now a social experience, Kat? What's been the larger scope of this?
So the larger scope of this is that with the 2018 midterms, we are seeing a lot of companies getting engaged in encouraging their users to vote. And now for many of these companies, this is not the first time that they have encouraged their users to vote, but they certainly are ramping up efforts in this area. We're seeing everything from, you know, banners on the top of Facebook pages that say, you know, today is the voter registration deadline in your state, remember to register. Or we're seeing things where social media companies will link you directly to something like TurboVote, where you can actually be registered.
Is there a partisan or issue-oriented thrust to any of this, Kat?
No, it is not. When I was talking to a lot of the companies, many of them really stressed the idea that this is nonpartisan. Someone from Bumble told me that, you know, this is not about advocating for a particular issue. This is about making sure users understand the importance that voting has, and that this is really an opportunity for them to use their voices. And many of the companies feel that with, you know, such large platforms and with millions or billions of monthly users, they have a really great social responsibility to try to encourage users to exercise their voting rights.
And a lot of them work by way of encouraging users to encourage others.
Yeah, that's certainly an aspect of it. Research shows that personal connections are a really great motivator for behavior. So if someone you're close to encourages you to do something, you are much more likely to do it. And so social networks certainly can capitalize on that.
And Nasim Makia, that seems to be the thrust of what you're doing with Outvote.
That's exactly right. You know, we see campaigns spending a lot of their budget on ads and kind of less personal approaches. And so that's kind of why we started, was to get friends encouraging each other to vote. We know that it can be as much as, you know, a single friend telling you to go vote. It could be as valuable as like 10,000 ads. It's pretty crazy how much that matters to folks.
How does your app work, Nasim?
So basically, we try to provide you with all the information you need to kind of encourage your friends to vote. So we'll tell you if your friends, which of them live in critical swing districts, which might make you more likely to really reach out, even if you haven't, talked to them in a while. We'll tell you if they've missed past midterms, which might, you know, help with some of the drop off we see in every midterm. You know, we go from 60% or so turnout in presidentials to 40% in the midterm. So that can help with that. And then we provide you with kind of pre-written messages that includes all the links and infos they need, you know, to go to like vote.org to check your registration status and things like that.
I've gotten cards in the mail saying this is what your voting record's been. Now, they don't say who I voted for, but they say when I voted. And of course, it's very right. It's very high, and I'm very proud of that. But it's also kind of creepy. Have you had any feedback along those lines?
Yeah, you know, this is something new that I think, you know, is going to come to light a little bit in this election with all this kind of peer-to-peer, friend-to-friend, you know, chatter around elections and encourage people to vote. It turns out, you know, this is public record. And I think there's a positive effect in that, which is that, you know, for a lot of people, just the fact that their friends might find out they didn't vote might be enough of a reason to go to the polls, which, you know, the net result is a good thing, but it can make people uncomfortable, especially if they didn't know that that was public information. And that is the case for some people.
Kat Hofacker, are you finding that this is primarily for younger voters? I mean, I know that the social apps, or I'm sorry, the social platforms, social media platforms, you know, if it's billions, there's a lot of different kinds of people on those platforms. But does the thrust of these things tend to be toward younger voters?
Now, a lot of the companies mention when they launch these voting initiatives that, you know, younger voters are certainly a demographic they really want to focus on. Mm-hmm. However, a lot of these things are geared broadly that any of their users can utilize them. However, because younger voters do tend to have the lowest turnout of any demographic, there is potential that they could be most impacted by this, especially when we're talking about apps like Tinder, because the vast majority of Tinder's users are under 30. And that falls into that young voter demographic.
Bumble brings people together for love and friendship, as their saying goes. Politics fits in there. How?
So Bumble is a company that they say they lead with their values. But basically what they are doing with this is they are letting their users put their values forward, where they are encouraging their voters to their users to register, but they are also allowing them to have a badge that says, I am a voter, I am not a voter, I decided to sit this one out. And so their place is really putting it there so that people can display it if they are very proud of it, and then it can be something that fosters conversation.
Nassim Makia, what do we know about digital natives that informed, you know, your work on the Outvote mobile app? Just natives, people who've grown up with it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, basically, we know that it's a really strong channel to connect. You want to connect with people where they are. You know, we had a question early on of, do we want to make this for email and other channels? And we felt like texting was something that, especially younger folks, people who are going to be on apps, you know, we find our users are between 20 and 35 mostly. You know, that's what they're doing already. So you want to kind of work with the channels they're already on, which is why you see people working on social media now so much more. And you start to see that budget that's spent on TV and radio slowly shifting to social media, texting, things like that.
Do they tend to be one party or another, or independents, Nassim?
For us, you know, Outvote, the main app, is actually a partisan app. So we only deploy for Democrats and progressives, although we did make a version for vote.org that's nonpartisan. But you see both, you know, Republicans. There was an article in the New York Times a couple of days ago about how Republicans are making all these white labeled apps. And so it's kind of like the same app with a different candidate's name or a different cause name. And they're getting people to come in there and have different tasks around social media to go comment or go share. So I think both sides are using it in slightly different ways.
And Kat Hofacker, have you found that some apps are more directed toward a particular party?
I have not, at least in what I've seen in my reporting. These companies seem really determined to keep the efforts really broad and to just bring it to their users, whatever their political persuasion is. And there is the issue with young voters where a lot of them do tend to be unaffiliated or independent, so that could certainly play a factor in it. But for the most part, it's all nonpartisan.
You wrote that tech companies are not trying to influence the vote. How do you know that? Just because they tell you, or what do we know?
Well, with a lot of these companies, voter registration is what a lot of them are doing. And it's really hard to be partisan with something like registration because they're not saying, here's a link to register as a Democrat. They're just saying, here is a link to register to vote. So when you're doing something like registration, it's really easy to appear nonpartisan and unbiased.
Nasim Akia, how are you monetizing this app?
So we charge campaigns or organizations to be on it. So, you know, we're working with folks like Move On and Flippable and Swing Left, and they basically pay a monthly fee to be on the platform, as it's kind of a referral system for them. So folks come in, they feel like they're volunteering for those great organizations. They've done the hard work of building these volunteer bases. And so that's kind of what they're paying for.
614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're talking about social media and apps, smartphone apps, that kind of a thing, to get out the vote, to encourage votes. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guests, you just heard from Nasim Akia. He's founder of Outvote. That's a mobile app that reminds users to vote, or allows users to remind other people to vote. Kat Hofacker writes about politics for USA Today. She just wrote about apps or social media platforms that are using their technology to get out the vote. 614-292-8513 is our number to call if you have a question or comment. Lyft and ride sharing apps are getting involved to take people to the polls. How's that working, Kat Hofacker?
So the way this is working is Lyft said, and Uber is doing this as well, but Lyft said that this is a much larger effort than anything they've done previously. But basically what they are doing is they are offering users discounted ride to the polls on election day. You are able to enter your zip code and you get a code for a 50% off ride. Lyft is also working with certain nonprofit groups to target underserved communities. For example, these could be communities who do not have access to a lot of transportation. These could be Americans with disabilities who historically have a very hard time getting to the polls, things like that. And those nonprofits are working to facilitate free rides for those communities.
Nasim Akia, what about that? What about when it comes down to actually getting out the vote physically?
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing could be more important. You know, we're not trying to replace that. We're trying to support it, and use the fact that this is something folks can do very quickly that has a huge impact, right? So right now what people can do is they can donate to campaigns or they can volunteer a ton of their time. And so, you know, volunteering is huge. Door knocking, offering rides, probably the most impactful thing you can do. But it's a big ask for most people. So at Outvote, we're trying to say, hey, you can spend 10 minutes on this app. Make sure to remind your friends and they'll be 10, 20% more likely to vote because of a single text. So just as important, if not more so.
Yeah. And Kat Hofacker, what are the expectations how this could change the trajectory of politics in the United States?
There hasn't really been a lot of discussion about that yet, but these apps say that they have registered, you know, thousands of users so far. And so I think if this is successful and if they consider this a worthwhile effort, I think you could continue to see many companies who are investing in voter registration or voter engagement efforts. And maybe we will start to see something like a lot of people being registered through these platforms. Right now, I think it's still early to tell what effect that this could have, but we know that social media in general is playing an increasingly large role in our lives.
And Nasim Akia, what are you learning from Outvote that prepares you for the next iteration? What would you do differently?
Yeah, so we're studying that right now. I think we'll know a little bit more, you know, agree that we'll kind of learn how this all played out, post-election and, you know, how things changed from the last cycle. But we're studying the effect of, messages sent. We're doing a randomized control trial to make sure that what we're doing is effective. We did this over the primaries and found that a single text made folks 10% more likely to vote. And, you know, we'll be studying again during the elections with a much larger sample size. We'll probably actually work with a couple of our partners on publishing those results post-election.
Huh. And so I could be using Outvote and I could get a notification that this many people that are on my my contact list are in a certain zip code that's a hot district, and that's how it works?
Yeah, that's part of it. So we might send you a push notification. Hey, you know, 10 people in this, you know, upcoming critical swing district, you know, so take the time to remind them, you know, or it just might be something a little bit more generic. But yeah, there's all kinds of campaigns we run. We find that telling folks who they know in those swing districts is really exciting for people as a way to make an impact, especially if they're in a big city where they feel like, hey, maybe my vote, you know, it's strong blue or strong red. My vote isn't as important here.
You know, Kat Hofecker, I read that, say, like, Facebook's getting into it. They're putting banners over the top of the page saying, get out the vote, don't forget to vote, and that kind of thing. I haven't gotten anything like that. What am I doing wrong?
That's really interesting, and I honestly do not know the answer to that. It could be that they are targeting that based on, you know, maybe they're putting more emphasis on places with early voting. Mm. It could also depend on the privacy settings for your Facebook account.
Okay. And if somebody doesn't want to be involved in any of this, say on like on Bumble, I don't want to, or on Tinder, that's not something I'm interested in. Is that something they have to opt into, or do they need to opt out of it?
Well, right now, the way that these efforts are structured, if it's something like, you know, a banner on Facebook or on Bumble, if it's something like a button, you can certainly just scroll past that or choose not to participate in it.
Okay. Well, Kat Hofecker, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
Kat Hofecker writes about politics for USA Today, and Nasim Makia, founder of Outvote. That's a mobile app that reminds users to remind others to vote. Thanks for joining us. Appreciate your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
We will continue with Tech Tuesday, so stay with us. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. If you're still looking for a way to startle trick-or-treaters, try a connected device. Contributing editor at Android Central, Russell Holly, wrote about how to make use of connected devices for Halloween decorations, and he joins us by phone. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So what, are you trying to scare little kids or what? What's going on?
I'm trying to scare all of the kids. It doesn't really matter what size they are.
Well, when did this occur to you that something so diabolical would be fun?
Torturing my kids was when this started. I have connected bulbs throughout my house that change color. And if my kids do not get up at a certain time, I tell my Google Home that my kids are late and they turn all of the lights in their bedrooms red. And my kids know that they are in trouble. And I don't even have to leave the kitchen.
I just don't know what it would be like to have a dad like you. So, yeah, what happens in the kitchen?
No, so just, you know, that's...
Oh,
that's
that you just
my,
operate
my
it from
Google
the kitchen.
Home is. Yeah, so I just, you know, I just do the voice thing from there, and the lights turn red, and they know that that they've either slept too late or, you know, they've taken too long to get ready, and so they rush down the stairs. So, yeah, when Halloween came around last year, it occurred to me that I could use some of this stuff on the front porch as people are coming up and have expanded that over the course of the year. You know, there are people who have connected doorbells that will allow for certain routines throughout the house to happen when you press the doorbell. And one of those things can be to change a light or to play sounds and things like that. So you could really have a lot of fun with this kind of thing at your front door. And, you know, there are connected buttons like the Logitech Pop. They're $25 buttons that when you press them, you can configure them to do pretty much anything. And so one of the first things I did was I set it on underneath of a platform on my front porch. So people came up onto the front porch, stepping on the top, step on my front porch, pressed this button and allowed all of the lights to turn red and allowed the smoke machine to come on and allowed the music to start playing. So just by reaching my front doorstep, you were already kind of surprised by all of these things happening. And I didn't even have to answer the door yet, So it was, it had, a lot of kind of fun effects.
What's the Logitech Pop Smart button?
Yeah, so it's just this really simple connected button. It's inexpensive, and you can program it to do pretty much anything. That's its job. It's something that Logitech made so that you can they're really designed for having in the office or in your bedroom or something like that. And if you want to push a button to turn on, say, a power strip that's connected to the internet somewhere, or if you want to turn on lights in your house in a specific place, you can control them through this button, where a single press will do something or a double press will do something, and you can configure them to do pretty much anything. But they're kind of sturdy, so I made it so that you could step on them in order to generate this effect.
And for this, I love it how you set this up. It's kind of like practically you've been looking at too much, it's like a recipe. For this, you'll need a good smoke machine, Logitech Pop Smart button, and Samsung Smart Things outlet. What's that?
Yeah, so this is just a connected outlet. It allows you to turn simple electronics on and off from the internet or from Amazon Echo or something like that. These are really popular with very simple coffee machines. For people in kitchens who, like, as part of the wake-up routine for getting up in the morning, the coffee maker just starts going as soon as you have told it to start going, and that way by the time you're out of the shower, the coffee is ready. But if you don't drink coffee like me and still want to torture children, you can connect these to a smoke machine and get this kind of rise out of someone as they come up to your front porch.
So how's it working so far?
So far, it's been working great. The only problem that I really have is that the smoke machine isn't quite fast enough. So a lot of times the smoke doesn't turn on until they've already started knocking on the door. But smoke machines are like that. They're just not very fast.
Now, I was going to say, how far away do they have to be, or does it start coming out while they're standing there?
Yeah, so the smoke machine will start like as they're sitting on the porch, waiting, as I'm giving them candy and talking about stuff, and they look down and realize that there's smoke everywhere that wasn't there before.
You already talked about setting your front porch lights red when someone walks to the door. That is pretty creepy. You need Philips Hue bulbs. Are those special ones?
Yeah, the Philips Hue bulbs come in either white or white with color. The white with color ones are a little more expensive, but they come in a bunch of different shapes, so you can get them for things that just connect to your normal outdoor lights. Or if you want to rig a special light up somewhere, you can do that. A lot of the Halloween decorations that you put in the yard rely on kind of specialty bulbs that aren't always supported by Philips Hue bulbs, but anything that uses a normal light socket, you could use these for.
And then the Hue motion sensors, is that the thing you step on, or is that something you walk by?
It's something you walk by, and the Hue motion sensors are really cool because they're wireless and they're very small, so they're very easy to hide, and they work pretty much anywhere as long as it's on the same wireless network as the Hue bulbs. And so you can set these, on a front porch or even kind of on your steps leading up to your, your house. And they can be at a pretty decent distance and not having any real problems there. But as soon as it detects motion, it will follow whatever command you've given it. So usually it's, turning the lights on or increasing the brightness or something like that. And so it's great for kind of catching someone by surprise when they've walked by something and suddenly, it lights up in whatever color you've told it to.
All right. So these seem pretty mild, but then we get to the triggering a scream when someone presses the doorbell. And that's scary.
It is scary. And this one is actually my grandfather's fault. My grandfather, for the last 20 years, he is an auto mechanic for a really long time. And he rigged his front doorbell every year at Halloween to a car horn that he had mailbox. And so when you came up on Halloween and pressed the doorbell, instead of getting the doorbell sound, you would get a car horn in the mailbox that was like at chest height at the door. And it was just terrifying. So this is not as bad as that. I have toned it down a little bit from my grandfather, who at the ripe old age of 86 still thinks that is hilarious.
I have to say, every year I say I'm not going to get it out. And every year I do, I have a bowl. And in the middle of it is a head. And it's motion sensor. And it starts crying or sobbing or humming creepy stuff. And the lips don't move, and it acts like it's kind of, it can't move its lips, and it's paralyzed, and it's kind of trying to talk. It's made kids cry, though. You know, I'm just saying. So, all right. So to do this Scream thing, you need an Amazon Echo Dot, which is pretty affordable. What else?
You can take the Amazon Echo Dot, and you can set it up either to a simple Bluetooth speaker, or you can have a battery connected, you know, set up to go to it. And really the key is to have anything connected to it that will send commands to an Amazon Echo remotely, because that's what you really want. You want the Echo to be somewhere where it can receive instructions remotely, and then you can have either a Ring doorbell or you can have the Logi pop buttons. There are a couple different options here, but the basic idea is to have a set of pre-selected tracks. It can be, you know, any kind of Halloween sound. I chose screams just because it was funny, but you can really choose anything. And the idea is that when someone presses the doorbell, the speaker is kind of hidden off to the side. And so you get that, you know, the volume from the scream kind of right there next to you.
I could just sense your enthusiasm, by the way.
It's great. And it's so much easier. You know, 10 years ago, I used to have to sit on my front porch dressed up like a scarecrow and be like perfectly still and then move around when someone looked at me. And it was a lot of work on my part to sit still for that long. I don't have to do any of that anymore.
Life. Oh, the convenience of technology.
That's right.
You said if you don't have an Echo Dot, no worries. The same trick works on Google Home.
Yep. Anything that you know, does kind of the connected speaker system, if you have one of the full Google Homes or if you have one of the cheaper Google Home Minis, they are just as easy to hide, you know, either through a battery connected thing or just plugged in if you have an outlet near your front door.
Now, the last one, turn all the lights off when you open your door. I'm not quite sure.
It's a, you know, to let people think that your house is haunted. So you open the door and you're like, hey, how's everybody doing? And then all the lights cut off. And then you're like, I didn't do that because obviously I'm standing here holding the bowl of candy. So it's a way of, you know, you got to play it up a little bit and make it seem like your house is haunted.
Oh, so you need, that's what the convincing scream is. You can't buy that. You have to do it.
Right.
So you still want to get in the act a little bit.
Every once in a while, yeah.
Samsung SmartThings multi-purpose sensor. What's that?
This is another one of those kind of motion-activated sensor things that'll work in a couple of different kinds of ways. You know, Samsung makes one of these sensors that is actually a really nice home safety thing because it'll act as a moisture sensor or you know, kind of a CO2 sensor version of it. But this one's just another kind of simple motion sensor kind of thing where when the door opens, the motion sensor or the sensor over the door is broken, that connection is broken, and then you can define an action based on that. You know, so a lot of times these are this version of them is a security thing. Every door has a you know, every security door has one of those you know, kind of closed open sensors, and this is just, you know, when the door is open, then this is the action I want you to take. The action there is turn off all the lights.
You asked at the bottom of the article, got any other connected home tricks you're excited to pull on visitors this Halloween? Share them with us in the comments. Did you get any?
I haven't gotten any yet. I've been hoping that somebody else is, that I'm not the only person who is taking these unfortunately expensive things and using them to torture children. But
you know what?
I'm probably the only one.
The scariest thing that ever happened to me when I was a kid trick or treating was we went up, we said trick or treat. This old man opened the door and he said, "Okay, show me a trick and I'll give you a treat." We were all like, "Ah!" We ran away. So scared the heck out of us. All right, so if anybody has any ideas and wants to share them with Russell Holly, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Russell, you wanted to talk about an affordable smartphone. You really astonish us.
Yeah, so you know, we've had a lot of phones that have come out this year with high-end price ranges that are up in the $1,000 range, and that's not great. For a lot of people who are looking for a new phone that is, you know, kind of their only computer in a lot of cases, it's still a really expensive investment. And one of the things that we've had for the 3 or 4 years that they've been around is this company OnePlus, and their big deal every time that they release a phone is to have this phone be the phone that does all of the stuff that the heavyweights from Apple and Samsung and these other companies do, but for 60% of the price. And that has been largely true over the last couple of years, but it has been most true with this most recent release called the OnePlus 6T. It was announced yesterday, and we've had access to it for about a week and a half now, and it's an impressive phone that does, you know, like they advertise, 90% of the things that you get from a Pixel 3 or a Galaxy S9 or an iPhone XS. But for $549 instead of the $850 or $950 that you would normally see this phone at.
What are you missing?
The camera isn't quite as good. It doesn't have wireless charging built in. It is water resistant, but not waterproof. But it is an incredibly fast phone. It is the first phone here in the United States where instead of having a fingerprint sensor on the back of the phone or on the front of the phone, kind of away from everything, the fingerprint sensor is actually very cleverly built into the screen itself. So when you look at the front of the phone, all you really see is the display. But if you put your finger on a specific spot on the display, it lights up and the fingerprint sensor is built into the display, which is something we're going to see a lot more of in the future to kind of see this stuff hidden underneath of the display so that it doesn't take up space elsewhere on the phone.
What is OnePlus Phone Company? Who's behind it?
OnePlus is a kind of a offshoot of a company based out of China, but they are a company that does a lot of work specifically here in the United States and in India to be kind of this unique standalone phone brand, as they've worked really hard to kind of establish this brand and try to be their own company. But their parent company makes a lot of really popular phones in China mostly.
And its operating system, they call it Oxygen OS.
This is a special version of Android that they work on. They take the Android operating system and they heavily optimize it so that it is very, very fast for the places that it needs to be. It gives you a lot of customization options. If you prefer that the text on, you know, the menus be blue instead of white, you can, you know, you have that option and a lot of other kind of personalization things. And yes, it's they call it Oxygen, but it is the latest version of Android is what's running on the phone.
All righty. Another phone you wanted to talk about is meant for people who want to play games on their phones. It's ROG or Rogue or what?
ROG.
Oh, just ROG. Okay.
Asus has this brand that has been part of their computers for a long time called the ROG brand, and it is Republic of Gamers.
Oh.
And this is for their computers. These are very you know, kind of flashy laptops and desktops with, you know, bright LEDs all over them and you know, a lot of performance under the plastic to show you that this is built to play a lot of video games on. And it's not easy to do that with a phone, because phones are pretty much, you know, kind of a glass on one or two sides and a camera and a couple of buttons, and that's pretty much it. But they've made this phone, this what they call the ROG phone, with a lot of hardware on the inside. It goes, the processor is one of the fastest that you will ever find, and the video card is also very impressive. But it accomplishes this performance by having this special kind of cooling system on the back that you would see in a computer. And it actually has special accessories that clip onto the phone to allow the phone to cool down faster when you're playing kind of graphically intense games. But the weirdest thing is, there are a pair of invisible buttons on the top of on the side of the phone, so that when you hold the phone in this kind of widescreen format, you have trigger buttons that you would normally have on a normal gaming controller, like an Xbox controller.
Yeah.
You would have these kind of trigger buttons, and they use this ultrasonic sensor so that when you press your fingers down on what feels like just the normal side of the phone, it actually registers a button press in the game, and you can make it, you know, make that button do really kind of whatever you want. So you effectively get these two extra buttons that you wouldn't get on any other phone just for playing that game.
Now, the fan, it's cooling down the phone. Is it noticeable?
It is noticeable. It's not loud, but you definitely feel it cool down. And there are these kind of side splits. And I feel very silly saying this. So there are side splits that also breathe some of that air onto your fingers.
Okay, that's weird. Yeah.
Which is a thing that you get when you're playing games, is that your fingers can sweat when you're holding a warm controller. And so that's like the whole design there is to help, you know, not just cool the phone down, but also give you some air around your fingers.
How big is this thing?
It is bigger than your average smartphone. It is a little bit thicker. It is a little bit taller, and that's by design. Asus, you know, is targeting people who want bigger screens with the, you know, brighter screens and you know, faster refresh rates. And so this is designed to kind of be a bigger, bulkier thing on purpose. And it accomplishes all of the things that it set out to accomplish. Very few of the things that when the phone manufacturer says, "Hey, we do this thing." They don't really come off as gimmicks. It's really just whether you play enough games on your phone to justify this experience and the $899 price tag.
Wow. Okay, so it's not cheap.
No.
You can still make phone calls, and it still has a camera and all that kind of stuff, or what? Is it actually a phone, I guess?
It is actually able to make phone calls.
Okay.
I've only done it once. But it worked just fine. Yeah, I mean, this is a normal phone when you want it to be, but it has just all of this incredible extra stuff for people who want more than a phone. And some of this is actually kind of practical. You can connect it to a mouse and a keyboard and those kind of things and actually use it as a computer in some situations if you really wanted to. But the big selling point here is this video game aspect. But it's a fascinating, albeit kind of confusing phone.
For the hardcore gamers in your life who deserve another $900 phone. We only have about a minute left, but I did want to talk about the adaptive controller for Xbox. Microsoft started selling this. It's for people with disabilities.
This is the coolest thing that I think any gaming company has ever done. This is it's a huge pad with just every kind of sensor you can imagine designed to connect to specialty wheelchairs, designed to connect to you know, accessibility computers and things like that to give as many differently abled people as possible the ability to play Xbox games as comfortably as physically possible. It's a labor of love by the Xbox development team, and watching there's a Gamers with Disabilities channel watching Microsoft work with these people to you know, make sure that it fits their needs has been a genuine pleasure to see.
How much?
These start at about $70, and then there are a couple of accessories that vary depending on what it is that you need for your needs instead of, you know, stuffing everything into one box.
Let's make sure we put that on the Christmas list, shows so that we can remind people about that. That's pretty cool.
Absolutely.
Russell Holly, thanks so much for joining us as always.
Thank you for having me.
That's Russell Holly, contributing editor for Android Central. And that's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks a lot for listening. And don't forget to vote. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.